Scientists sometimes complain about the difficulty of dealing with complex arguments on a medium like this, especially when the matter at issue is a really big one, like climate change. We've decided to do something a little unusual this morning. We're devoting a significant chunk of this last half hour of the programme to the ideas of the pioneering and extremely controversial climate change scientist, James Lovelock, the man who gave us what is known as Gaia theory. Gaia, of course, is the name the ancient Greeks used for the goddess they worshipped as the personification of the earth. We gathered a group of seven eminent figures from disciplines with a bearing on climate change, fueled them with copious quantities of coffee and biscuits, and over a long evening and much of the following morning, they put James Lovelock through a rigorous process of examination on the case he makes in his most recent book, The Revenge of Gaia. He explained what he was trying to achieve.
I wrote the book because I suddenly realised that the public were unaware of how serious was climate change. They knew about it kind of vaguely as something that might happen, but both they and the scientists treated the Earth as if it was another planet, almost something you could discuss theoretically, not as a real place that we live on and is going to change in quite drastic ways and quite soon. The Earth is a remarkable planet. It's a cool, beautiful world because of the life that's been on it, and that's been present for at least 3.5 billion years, and always, as the sun has warmed up, and it's warmed up 25% since life began, kept the planet a comfortable place for life. Not perfect, but always regulating it comfortably. Now, I think most scientists nowadays are agreed that that is so. It's a self-regulating system. I've been living with this view for 40 years. General science has only been with it, perhaps, at the most for the last 5 to 10. And I think they perhaps are still living in their separated disciplines and not seeing it as a whole. So I've been very privileged to see this global climate position from the top down. It's a view that leads me perhaps to make more extreme predictions than might otherwise be made, but I think it's a justified position.
And extreme some of his predictions certainly are. James Lovelock sees much of the Earth becoming an arid wasteland by the end of this century.
The world, when it gets very hot, will not be able to produce anything like as much food as it does now. So, quite literally, billions of us are going to be faced with starvation. I suspect that people will be migrating towards the better, more comfortable regions of the Earth, like the Arctic Basin particularly. I'm told that President Putin actually said at a climate meeting, well, climate change is going to be good for Russia. It'll make Siberia a really flourishing and special place. And to an extent, he may be right.
There's an equally striking dismissal of our current efforts to cut carbon emissions. For an appropriate comparison, James Lovelock reaches back to the British policy of appeasement in the 1930s.
I tend to regard the very serious and earnest attempts that have been made at meetings like Kyoto to avoid climate change by political action as very like the Munich meeting before World War II. It was run by good intentions, but almost wholly impractical.
Our panel got to work on the science that underpins these arresting statements. James Lovelock has based many of his predictions on the work of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, the body set up by the UN to monitor climate change. He believes that as the century progresses, the temperature will rise 8 degrees centigrade in temperate regions and 5 degrees in the tropics. There was this challenge from Dr. Vicky Pope, head of the Climate Prediction Programme at the Hadley Centre, which is part of the Met Office.
Jim, I would say in your book that some of the changes that you're talking about are certainly within the range that IPCC is predicting, but I think they're towards the upper end of that range rather than being something that's certainly going to happen. And it may be that we can put things right before the very dramatic sea level rise changes that could occur in the distant future.
And this from Dr. Brian Hoskins, a Royal Society research fellow who chaired the Royal Commission on Environmental Pollution, which advised the government on targets for reducing carbon emissions.
I would say he's painted a picture which is slightly more bleak than I would go for, but the picture I would paint is certainly a very serious one. I think he's gone a bit over the top in sea level rise. I mean, it's comparing it with the last ice age changes, I think, is not what one expects on the shorter timescale anyway.
If we're talking about the book, nowhere in the book will you find my suggesting anywhere that sea level rise per se is going to be an immediate problem. And I agree entirely with Brian and with the IPCC report. This is a slow process. It'll take time. Indeed, I see storm surges as much more serious than sea level rise. They're the things that matter. And Hurricane Katrina was a fine example of the damage done there.
Though he's unquestionably a green guru figure, James Lovelock's views on energy are certainly not in the conventional green mould. He champions nuclear power as the best option available for maintaining our way of life without adding greatly to carbon emissions.
I'm not a nuclear fanatic, but it happens to be the cheapest, the cleanest, and the most reliable source of electricity. That's the key thing, electricity. You can't run a modern city without it. And about the only thing we can really rely on later in this century will be nuclear.
Lord Oxborough, Ron Oxborough, is a geologist by training and has acted as a science advisor to the Ministry of Defence. He's a former chairman of Shell Transport and now heads Shell Springboard, which channels money into businesses which can reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
I think the answer is to the question, is nuclear essential? The answer is no. Would it be helpful? The answer is yes. I think we've got four ways of generating electricity. We have gas, we have coal, we have nuclear, and we have renewables. And we're probably going to need at least three of those. And probably the choices between those will largely be made on political grounds. Nuclear has undergone a major transformation, and there aren't many of the problems around today that there were 20, 30 years ago. But if there is strong public opinion against this, it simply may not be worth the candle, and we may have to rely on coal.
Susan Owens had her doubt too. She's the Professor of Environment and Policy at Cambridge.
It's a pity if we frame this debate in terms of supply-side options. How should we be supplying energy? We should be concentrating very much more on our profligate use of energy in our society. I do think the nuclear option raises a number of real problems, which I don't think you fully address in the book. There is, of course, the problem of public and political acceptability of nuclear power. And in a democracy, we can't just wish that problem away. It's a very real issue. There are also issues of cost. I don't think I would agree with you, Jim, that nuclear power is the cheapest source of electricity.
It is.
There are problems, possibly, if you went for a rapid nuclear program, there are problems of the sheer capacity to deliver such a program.
This is one issue where I find myself in almost total disagreement with everything that Susan has said. On public perception of nuclear, this is a very ephemeral, trivial thing. We found in the last 2 years, by stressing the need for nuclear, that it's been possible to switch in Britain public opinion from about something like 98% against round to 40-something percent in favour.
James Lovelock is equally iconoclastic on the subject of wind power. He doesn't believe it can make a worthwhile contribution to our energy needs and is vociferous about the impact wind turbines would have on his beloved Devon countryside. One of the panellists, Professor Andrew Watson, was a former student of Dr. Lovelock's, but about this, he was unconvinced.
We are going to need every source of energy that we can get, and wind power is one of those, which may never be a huge source of energy, but if you can save a few tons of carbon dioxide here and there by using wind energy, then I think that that's good. And at the end of the day, I also think that they are themselves not that ugly, and that in places they actually enhance the landscape.
They call me a NIMBY, not in my backyard. Well, my backyard is the English countryside, quite literally. And I see the countryside as the face of Gaia. And I don't want windmills despoiling it. I don't think it's a necessary as a source of energy. A single nuclear power station like Hinkley Point produces energy the equivalent of windmills, 3 per mile, going from Hinkley Point to Land's End. That's 1,000 miles. And this seems to be a ridiculous way of getting the same amount of energy.
Over the question of wind power, Susan Owens of Cambridge supported Dr. Lovelock.
My great fear is that if we talk in terms of either saving the planet or having windmills, what we might end up with is a lot of windmills in very beautiful areas and a lot of CO2 as well, and yeah, we won't have saved the planet, but we will have despoiled some of our remaining semi-wild countryside.
The panel's judgments on the impact the book will have on public attitudes to climate change were mixed. Vicky Pope from the Hadley Centre feared it might be counterproductive.
I think this book paints a very bleak but possible picture of the future, and I think that's the point. It is possible, but it gives the impression that perhaps it's much more likely than many people think. The danger, I think, is that people will either say this is such a huge, difficult problem, you know, on an individual scale, I can't do anything about it, and that can lead people to inaction simply because they don't know how to tackle it. What I hope is that it will encourage people to take the problem seriously.
Dr. Hans von Storch directs the German Institute of Coastal Research and also holds a chair at Hamburg University.
When I read this, then I would say the response could be something like panic, kill your neighbour if he has three cars, or considering it the usual oversell. And in that sense, I don't think it is really helpful because all this is on a very high level of abstraction. And so it is just saving the world. It has nothing to do with our lives, really. We cannot improve the world as individuals. We can sort the garbage. We can use the bike to go to the office or things of that sort. And many people think that is a significant contribution. And that's one element which I really like with Jim's book, that he's making clear that this doesn't help at all.
But Professor Andrew Watson broadly endorsed the approach of his former PhD supervisor.
There are plenty of voices saying the science is not sufficiently certain, we can go on for a few more years yet. And I think that it's very useful to have an eminent scientist step up to the plate and say, this is really, really serious. The only thing that I think is not quite right about it is that Jim says this will happen. I think it may very well happen, and that this is not inevitable, but it is likely unless we make serious efforts to do something about it.
There was a break while the panel drew together their conclusions, and afterwards I discussed them with James Lovelock and the panel chairman, Brian Hoskins. James Lovelock, sitting and listening to your peers discussing a session earlier on, I got the feeling of a group of people who are very sympathetic fundamentally to what you're saying and the message you're trying to get across. But perhaps if one could put it in almost political terms, think that you're a little bit guilty of spin, of choosing the worst case scenario whenever one's available. Do you think that's fair?
I'm not sure whether it's a compliment or a criticism.
Well, I think from scientists it's probably a criticism.
Well, no, I think as I explained to them, the book was a wake-up call, and it was addressed to an intelligent layperson in the public, not to scientists. And to an extent, I think spin is a necessary element in that.
Even to the extent of saying what you said at the time the book came out, before this century is over, billions of us will die, and the few breeding pairs of people that survive will be in the Arctic where the climate remains tolerable, which is both very dramatic and very definite.
I agree. I don't doubt that the probability that billions may die before the end of this century is quite high. And a natural consequence of this is that people will migrate to the Arctic basin where things will be a lot more tolerable. Let's hope enough of them are there to carry on.
Brian Hoskins, I got a sense, listening to your deliberations, that while you could see the force of using these extreme and dramatic terms and talking in that kind of very forceful language, you had some concerns that it might be counterproductive, that actually it could put people off.
Well, there's two things. One is taking the extreme side of the distribution, I think, can lead people to say, well, if you want to attack this, it's easier to attack as being an outlier. So if someone is a skeptic on climate change, they can say, but this is suggesting temperature rises which are out of the bounds of what most of the models give, or sea level rises which are out of the bounds. And so there is a difficulty of laying oneself open, I think, in a situation where I believe if you take just the middle of the road, it is actually so severe what we're talking about, that you don't have to go to the end of the distribution to make it sound apocalyptic, which is what the book does sound.
Do you think there's some justice to that, James Lovelock? Has what you've heard today made you question whether the tactic, if you like, was the right one?
Yes, I don't agree with it wholly, because the middle situation of a rise of 3 or 4 degrees Celsius could well lead to the same dire consequences that I mentioned, of billions possibly dying. It doesn't require the extreme for really serious things to happen.
Could I input something else? I mean, I think the language, I hope, would be, this is what might happen if we don't do something. Whereas the book tended to say, this will happen. I hope what really is the message is that this could happen if we don't take action now and in the next few decades.
Well, I was going to come on to that, James Lovelock, because there is this sense in the book that we have crossed the threshold. And you meant that, did you?
I meant it indeed. I think there is a great danger that the system has reached a point where it will not go back, whatever we do. And to look at it at its least value, nearly all climate scientists are agreed that if we could stop all fossil fuel burning magically today, it would still take 1,000 or more years before things got back to normal. We in a sense, have already changed the Earth far beyond its normal state, and it won't recover for quite a long time.
But the trouble with that message, as you transmitted in the book, is that it could be interpreted as a council of despair. People just say, well, let's eat, drink and be merry because we're all doomed anyway.
Exactly. But that is far from my intentions. It's, again, I keep repeating this, a wake-up call to make people realise how bad things are. I'm not trying to imply there's nothing we can do. I don't know whether cutting back fuel burning and emissions will do as much as is often claimed. It may be that we've reached a point, and in systems you do reach a point, where it will just proceed of its own accord to a final hot state, regardless of what we do. I don't know. This is a real danger that's there, and we must take it into account. We'd be irresponsible if we didn't.
I got the sense, Brian Hoskins, that the other area where you had some doubts about the book was over the scepticism about some of the options for trying to change things, particularly things like wind power. You thought they deserved perhaps a bit more credit than James Lovelock gave them.
I mean, I think it depends how you read the book. At the end of the chapter on energy, there is, I thought, what was a very balanced section saying that we need to consider everything. And nuclear is not a panacea. We need to think of a balanced set of options and move to that. And I would put energy conservation much higher on the list perhaps than was in the book. So there was that section of the book, but I felt before that there was too much of a tendency for my liking to dismiss some of the things that I think must be part of that mix or must be looked at, and the technology developed as rapidly as possible to see what the mix is likely to be in the future.
Did you accept that criticism?
Well, I accept it now, but remember, when the book was written, it was 2 years ago, and at that time, there was no sign whatever that nuclear power could be used in this country. Public opinion and the government were almost entirely against it. And if you like it, the book is a bit of a polemic in favour of nuclear power, particularly for the United Kingdom, because I think it would be very foolish not to use this valuable and safe source of energy.
But also slightly a polemic against things like wind power.
Ah, now there I must admit, I'm culpable. I just do not want them in my back garden, quite literally.
So you plead guilty to prejudice as much as
anything. Oh, indeed I do. Great prejudice.
And you think, Brian Hoskins, there's rather more to wind power perhaps than...
I believe that wind power must be part of that mix. The modern turbines are getting more and more efficient. And clearly we don't want to put them on the most beautiful hill as our first option. Who knows what we'll have to do later on, but we must plan properly. And wind power, I believe, as the technology develops, will become cheaper. And it must be part of that mix.
The other point that does strike one is that this book is getting a lot of attention at a time when we are all getting a constant message that says you can all make a difference with small things, whether it's bicycling to work or not using quite as much water as you might like to, or putting a wind turbine on your roof or whatever it is. And the implication of the book seems to be, actually, it's not in our hands as individuals. It's in the hands of government over things like nuclear power.
You're right in a way. That is an unfortunate impression, but it's not what I have in mind. I think that those kind of gestures, like solar panels on the roof and small windmills on the roof, are nice ideas, but they're mainly for the fairly wealthy middle class. At the moment, I can't see it as any more than a gesture that won't really do very much. I'm not against it because gestures are good, but I do think that strong action by governments is needed. It's too much to ask people of their own bat to do things.
It's true, Brian Hoskins. We're all being a bit sentimental and self-indulgent by thinking that tiny steps can make a real difference.
I think Jim does believe in the individual action, but I would put it high on the agenda that people shouldn't say this is a problem for someone else to sort out. It's nothing with me. Yeah. So I cycle to work every day, and I think that I'm doing the right thing by doing that. But equally, then the individual action should be putting pressure on politicians to actually make sure they do what is, in the end, the essential actions.
It's been a riveting discussion. Thanks very much to both of you and indeed to all those who've taken part this morning. Riveting indeed, and there's an extended version of that on the website.